Good evening. Oh, no coughing.
Okay.
Have you finished coughing? Has everyone finished coughing and drinking? And okay.
Unlikely. I have a tickle in my throat.
Good evening and welcome to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, I'm the director of the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. You can also stream us live at www.guardiantalkradio.com, and on that same website you can also download the app and take us with you when you're on the move, and you can also visit that site and listen to all the archive shows from over the last 3 years. So tonight I have three guests in the studio, which is a little packed in here. And one is impromptu. I just invited him along like at the last minute because I thought it would be a good conversation. So we have the brand new chief curator, finally, of the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, Miss Holly Bino, sitting in the studio with us. Welcome, Holly.
Good evening. Thank you, Amanda.
Finally, work visa came through. Woohoo!
So we can celebrate.
We can celebrate about that. Holly was a co-curator on the NE7. Which we had up for about 4 or 5 months at the gallery, from December through to whenever that was, whenever it came down, March. And that was the show which we spoke about race, economy, class, and privilege. And that was a really interesting show to work on, and we challenged the artists to grapple with some of those themes from Bahamian society. And one of those artists who was unable to have on the show at the time is Holly Perotti, who's also here with us tonight. Holly, welcome.
Yes, good evening. Thank
you. So we've actually got two Hollies, so it's going to be confusing. I'm going to call you HP and I'm going to call you HB, which also is confusing, so never mind. And then our final guest, who came into the mix because, in fact, Holly Bino, the current chief curator, has also just curated a show in New York, which was in the works before she came on board at NAGB, entitled Field Notes Extracts. And that's a show with a range of Caribbean artists, again inquiring about different narratives. So I'm going to read a little blurb off the website. So the narratives that tempt and contest charged landscapes and mythologies, contend with meaning and markers of becoming, exhume turbulent histories around colonization and its legacy of violence, and address important markers of spiritual and metaphysical transformation. And Holly Bino worked with very many artists, or not very many, but several artists on that project. And one of those was, again, Miss Perotti, who is here. So that's how that sort of show came together. And then Darwin, who is visiting us from New York and is a contemporary art collector. He also sits on the board of the Studio Museum and is someone I've been becoming very close to and who I like to get a lot of wisdom from on the contemporary art scene in the United States, and also how the African-American narrative is being told and how that connects with the Caribbean. And Darwin is now visiting us this week to discover more the Bahamian art landscape. And so I said, and he actually just was at Mocada last week and saw...
That's exactly right.
The two Hollies in the show. And so I said, oh, you saw the show. Come on the radio show.
Very nice.
So welcome.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. So we're going to sort of talk about all those things. I think I'll turn to Holly Perotti first, because you're the kind of anchor through all the projects. So you were in the NE7. You were in Mocada.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about, and also actually you've just recently done a big Bahamar commission.
Yes.
So you've been quite busy over these last few months. Your mm-hmm. practice very often deals with issues of identity mm-hmm. and belonging right. and things that it seems a lot of Bahamians and a lot of Caribbean folk are grappling with, right? Because we mm-hmm. have all these threads of narrative of where we're from, and you know, your last name would not be considered quote unquote Bahamian. So no. I'm sure you very often have your Bahamian-ness questioned.
Daily.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So your work very often deals with some of these issues. Has there been a growth in these three shows, or the commission and the two shows? Have the projects linked together? Because I know what you showed at the NE7 sort of linked a little bit with Passing Ports, which was a project you did in London about a year and a half ago?
No, it's 3 years now.
3 years. Oh, mm-hmm, God, time
2012.
Where you did a kind of series of passports, which yes. were questioning, again, you know, our racial heritage. And yes. and then the show in the piece in NE7 was, mm-hmm. again, about your different threads of ancestry from your grandparents. That's Talk right. a little bit about the Bahamara project and what you did for Field Notes.
The Bahamara project presented me with a new challenge to my work simply because I was asked to do large format, a scale that I'm not accustomed to. My work has always been quite intimate, very portable, and something that I prefer you to engage with very closely. So I, having come from that part of my portfolio where I am dealing with very small objects with a very large message, the Bahamara project challenged me to create a new format as well as to use more of my photography in this particular presentation. And that thinking on that scale, for lack of a better word, really introduced a new sense of how I want to see my work develop right now, at least. And, you know, it's just the format, again, has changed in that it's become larger.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was approached for the for contributing to the field notes at Makata, I just continued on that same vein where I produced two very large scale images, so that instead of engaging on that smaller composition, I want you to now be enveloped by my work.
Mm-hmm. I find that something I see quite a lot here, and very often I feel like it might be literally a problem of space, problem of studio space, a problem
Indeed.
Of like a mental space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we live in this quite constrained space mm-hmm. in many ways, mm-hmm. not only geographically, physically, but also really,
yes,
you know, mentally. And so it's all quite blinkered.
Yep.
Do you feel that, that Bahamara project then gave you that sort of freedom? Did they give you studio space?
I was offered studio space.
Mm-hmm.
However, it was a challenge simply because I was working very digitally and thinking about
right.
moving all of my equipment and
mm-hmm.
You know, cameras and computers. It was something that, you know, I really wanted to have as my own. I wanted
mm-hmm.
to somewhat work in my own contained space that I created, because of understanding the magnitude and the doors that are now opened from the other side. Instead of us opening our own doors,
mm-hmm.
those doors are opened to welcome in people like, you know, this gentleman
people
sitting
like
right
people,
here.
Darwin,
yeah.
And so, Holly, how did you, okay, first of all, the selection of artists. I mean, obviously, Holly Perotti's work fits in with the context that I read out. A lot of her work has dealt with these issues of, the legacy of colonization, the legacy of the, you know, mixed heritage that we all share, and this change of format. Was that a challenge for you as a curator?
I feel as though you need a little bit of context as to how the show came together.
Yeah. Mm.
So I started to have a conversation with Isissa Kumada John, who is the exhibitions coordinator at Makata, about 2 years ago. And I presented her with a new media plan of supporting video works. As Makata already had that project in the pipeline, I started to think in other ways about how to construct a space that could give us a better understanding of how we're considering the landscape, how we're considering personal subjectivities, and how we're considering the multiplicities that now exist in our visual language and the narratives that we need to invest in order to shift and change how people are considering Caribbean art
mm-hmm.
from the outside, from the inside as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, looking on the pool of artists that I've been working with for the past five years with ARC, I really like collaborating with professional artists who meet deadlines,
mm-hmm.
who are open.
Can I have that list?
You know what? and I think that this is the list. It's probably one of the more seamless shows that I've done over the past, you know, 3 years since we've been doing programming. So people who were professional, people who were thinking in-depthly about the space, and people who also were interested in collaborating, because it is about a close personal you know, collaboration as they develop the projects. So in the end, it was, it is a show featuring the work of Deborah Ann Zinger, who is from Jamaica.
Jamaica, yeah, who was just here for the pop-up, that great outdoor sculpture thing they did.
Freak Dancing.
Freak Dance. That was such Freak Dancing. Excellent show.
Yeah. Gilles Elie de Cossac, who has Martinican heritage but living mm-hmm. in Paris. He's also one of the only commercial artists that I know
mm-hmm.
working in the region or in the diaspora, who's very, very successful. He's been able to engage in a fine art practice and in a commercial practice in a really sort of interesting way. Mm-hmm. It's not very different. Mm-hmm. The end product, the output, looks the same. Mm-hmm. Vashti Harrison, who is, her heritage is from Trinidad, but she, I think she grew up in California, between California and Virginia. Joyri Manaya, who I met a few years ago, she is from the Dominican Republic, but she's been living in New York for in the last couple of years. Of course, HB, sitting across from me, who have had a working collaboration with for the last, what, 2.5, even 3 years?
At least.
Yeah. At least, yeah. Mm-hmm. Kelly Sinipa-Mary, who is an artist from Guadeloupe. And last, Jasmine Thomas-Gervin, who is Jamaican, but living and working in Trinidad for the last 25 years. For me, it was...
It's quite interesting already, just to note that almost everyone's not living where they came from, which I think is very common in the Caribbean, even if we're moving to another Caribbean nation.
Yes.
Like that we continue to move.
Yes, and I'm so, an itinerant.
Yeah.
Or have
yeah.
been.
You have been. Not anymore, lady.
Well, yeah, not anymore. At least for the next 2 years. Yeah, so for me, the engagement started foremost with their practices. So I was able to do a lot of research with them. And because I had an open collaboration and communication, mm-hmm. I was able to foresee the structure of the show. So moving out of any kind of understanding as to how we think about the Caribbean in an antiquated way visually, I began to really look at the landscape and how the landscape kind of informs everything, because it's the thing that we confront on a daily basis.
And I think it's the thing that very often is the first go-to when you're thinking of a cultural, of a marker of identity, right?
For sure.
I mean, it's always like here anyway, it's like, you know, the public sculpture is a conch shell or a lobster or,
yeah.
You know, we immediately go to the identity of the Bahamas is the ocean. The identity of the Bahamas is very often something natural.
So for me, it was looking at the landscape, but then seeing how the landscape really affected the inside.
Mm.
And these sort of... the personal ways in which we attest a kind of identity and the way that it has shifted tremendously over the past 20 years and the other influences that continue to compound like new visualities are really, really supremely interesting to me. So this was the massive artists that I brought together, because they were thinking about transformation, they were thinking about healing, they were thinking about personal politics, they were thinking about art history, and they were thinking about healing. And I think in my mind, I started to feel as though the piece could become really heavy. I mean, I call the show like a piece. It's like one project in my brain, because it has a really sort of powerful and distinct narrative when you're in the space. You know, it speaks about all sorts of traumas. It speaks about how artists are now inventing new ways to play, to deal with that trauma, so that it doesn't become only heavy or only contemplative. It kind of has gaps where you can almost rescue yourself from thinking about ways in which we continue to be co-opted, ways in which the ownership of the landscape, the ownership of ourselves, we continue to battle with these things. So for me, thinking about field notes. So field notes comes from this quotation that Rebecca Solnit used in her book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost. And as I was doing research and becoming more aware of the literature that I was focusing on, Vashti Harrison's piece, which was also called Field Notes, came upon me. And you know, this is it's an exploration through Trinidad, and it deals with mythology and ghosts and jumbies and ways in which we find certain safety in spaces, but also ways in which we're afraid to make these encounters because of what they can further reveal to us. So for me, it's about that like invisibility, that masking and unmasking that happens within practices that became really important as cement for the show.
Awesome. Well, okay, and we had Darwin has actually seen the show, even though he said he didn't get a chance to really engage with it. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the work you did for that.
Okay.
After that, we have to go to a quick break. So how you conceived your participation in that show and how this project you were able to work on here sort of led into that. We do have to go to a short break. I've got three guests in the studio with me this evening. Holly Bino, the current chief curator of the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas. Holly Perotti, a local Bahamian artist who's been working with the NAGB and with Holly and myself for really quite some time. And Mr. Darwin Brown, who is down from New York, but because he is discovering the Bahamian art scene and the Caribbean in a wider sense, and is here sort of doing a bit of research, but also just saw the show that we're now talking about. So we're going to have some input from him shortly after the break. You're listening to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson. I'm the director of the National Art Gallery, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, the director of the National Art Gallery, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. Tonight in the studio, I have Holly Bino, the current chief curator at the National Art Gallery, Holly Perotti, a Bahamian practicing artist who is exhibiting in a show entitled Field Notes, which is at Mocada in New York, that was curated by Ms. Bino. And we also have Mr. Darwin Brown, a New York-based collector and art enthusiast, who recently saw the show. Now, Darwin, I'm going to bring you in a little bit on the conversation. Now, Darwin, I grabbed him last night, who just came down on a sort of, in a way, a working vacation, because you're really
it's a
here.
Vacation.
Yeah,
that's
I mean,
exactly
you
right.
You take contemporary art seriously, as many of us do, and you know, it's not like a dilettante thing. You really like you're doing your research, you're reading your materials, you really want to find out about artists and you know why they're making what they make, and. And in New York City, you've been very active in mostly collecting African American art.
Exactly.
And you've been organizing these groups of artist talks, which are called the Mini Bar, mm-hmm. which is such a great name. The bar now stands for something, right?
Stands for the Black Artist Retreat.
Right. So the Mini Black Artist, but I like Mini Bar. And that the last iteration of that. So you've had a couple in different your apartment and someone else, curators, but you did one actually at the Mocada Museum.
That's exactly right. This past Friday.
Right. And so you can talk a little bit about what you're doing there with those artists, but then you actually had the opportunity to, and I know you said you couldn't really speak to it very deeply because you didn't have a lot of time to spend with it, but you actually were doing the talk in the show.
That's right.
Field Notes, which we're talking about right now. So why don't you talk a little about what you're doing in New York and how actually your interest in Bahamian art got piqued? Because when we first met, you were like, I've really only collected African American art because that speaks to a history I can connect to. But you're That's now right. beginning to discover the Caribbean.
That's right.
And how that kind of interconnects. So can you speak a little bit to that as well?
So I initially began following contemporary art seriously. I date back to 2002. And mm-hmm. so that's when I would say I began acquiring art and looking at the complexity that's involved in the art market and the art world. I realized the need to do a fair amount of research. And considering how vast the art world is, I tried to narrow down to some degree of focus. And the focus for me was coming from a place of my identity, which is that of an African American. So I was looking for creative expression by people like me, first and foremost, who have a history rooted in the United States. And as that kind of interest grew and explored more of our culture, kind of African American culture, you find that it's inextricably linked to other blacks of African descent. And so I began to explore creative expression coming out of African artists, and then by extension now, I learn a lot more about the Caribbean culture, Caribbean heritage, the various different iterations, if you will, from many friends of mine in New York who come from all the different islands of the Caribbean. And to fast forward to my most recent Caribbean experience in a trip here this past March where I came to the Bahamas specifically to sleep, drink, and lay on the beach and no other agenda. Thanks to Amanda, I happened to be introduced to an array of things that were going on here in the island as it related to the art world, and my motivations for the trip completely changed, and I spent an entire 5 days doing any and everything that I could to get acclimated to Art of the Bahamas, and was just blown away by the expansive history of creative expression from this particular place.
And a small place.
Very small
place. So you can
place.
Only imagine when you get to all these other places.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about your mini bars. What are you doing with those and how you ended up at Mercada?
So the mini bars are just as right here, we would call these mini bar colon artist talks. Mm-hmm. And this is a series of gatherings that are put on now, we would say every 2 months, organized by three artists and myself, the three artists being William Villalongo, who is a professor at Yale mm-hmm. School of Art. There's Valerie Pereno, a practicing or studio artist, and then Sonia Davis, mm-hmm. Who's a young photographer. So the objective really is just to bring artists together and give them an opportunity to learn about each other's practice. Mm-hmm. And in the process of having that dialogue, we thought it would make sense to make this a more expansive dialogue and introduced a smattering of kind of critical types, we would say, mm-hmm. those that write about art and curate art and so on. And then introduce maybe some collectors to the work mm-hmm. of artists that's currently being produced. But the predominant focus is to share the practice of artists who may not have kind of the marquee that some of the more celebrated artists mm-hmm. we encounter at the fairs and so forth might
mm-hmm.
have.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up at Mercada, and was that was that a setting that was appropriate? Because obviously it's very much around the Black experience. And
yes.
So you're in then a show, having the talk before they'd been at homes.
Right.
You're in a museum context.
That's right.
Within a show with a very deep connection to these social ties. Did it change anything in the talks for you to be in that institutional space, to be surrounded by work that was similar but different somehow?
I think it did. So if our focus is really just on the dialogue and the interaction of the individuals, we really want to de-emphasize the space. So we haven't been terribly focused on finding a permanent home.
Mm-hmm.
We're more focused on getting the right people together. And when I say the right people, just people that are genuinely interested and curious in artistic practice.
Mm-hmm.
And we will start with the two presenting artists, and then build around that those critical types, collectors, mm-hmm. and fellow artists that might have an interest in those folk. So in that sense, the first location was at a collector's home, simply because one of Valerie Pereno had a relationship with that collector. The next presentation was at my home, because we could easily get the guy that owned that space to open his doors,
mm-hmm.
that being me. And then we have all the four of us all know of and have deep regard for Mercada, its mission and so forth. And I think William Villalongo had a conversation with the current executive director, whose name is escaping me right now.
James?
I think so.
James Barlett?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And so in their dialogue, James expressed a lot of interest in what we were doing with the artist talks, opened the doors of Mercada as a space that we might consider for a future presentation. And that's how that came about. But to your point about, did that kind of change the dynamic? Well, if you move from the very personal space of an individual's apartment with artwork hung kind of reflecting that individual and so forth, you do have more of an institutional dynamic
mm-hmm.
when you're in kind of the confines of a museum, and with a curated show, if you will, around you, it begins to draw your attention away from that particular conversation. And the fact that our chairs and some tables and the screen and so forth were present in the middle of the showroom floor, it really interrupts the flow
mm-hmm.
of Holly's overall presentation, which speaks to why I feel that I absolutely want to and have to go back mm-hmm. to spend time in the show, because the feel of it was taken away by the other objects
mm-hmm.
in the room.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So how did you, you talked a little bit about how the Bahamara Commission changed your ideas for this particular show. So was there a change in the, when you two were speaking as the curator, were you expecting one thing and Holly came up with something totally unexpected? Or because she'd been through this idea, I mean, she talked about the intimacy and then...
Yes, the project went through several stages before it became, its final, mm-hmm. what it is now. I think when we started the when we started to speak about what Field Notes would become, I really emphasized to HP the significance of the landscape. And you presented, I can't remember the first proposal to me, but it wasn't Silent Sentinels with the silk cotton tree. I think perhaps it was closely related to Other and Passing Ports.
Yes, that's correct. Then which Other was the piece that was in the NE7.
Yes,
so,
yes. Yeah. Dealing with your family's identity, immigration.
Yes.
You know, how we format people, how we dictate mm-hmm. their identity and what that means now in a contemporary context in 2015, mm-hmm. and your kind of navigation through that. Mm-hmm. And as I developed the framework for the show, because of course it changes, curatorially it shifts, mm-hmm. you know, because you get your budget, then you get the space, then you figure out what you can move and what you can't move. So things need to be adjusted. And I think we were working on that to the 13th hour.
Yes.
Yes.
The logistics of it, yeah.
So as my curatorial statement became more refined and mm-hmm. I shared it with you, then mm-hmm. you were able to speak about how you were thinking about exploring the silk cotton tree, its legacy, yes. mm-hmm. and its importance in this landscape culturally.
Yes, yes. I think oftentimes when you go through my portfolio, you do see a lot of moments of isolation, and I don't only include that myself in that, but I also look at these objects that they have a certain utilitarian function or a romantic function, you know, with how culturally or personally people engage. But you find these objects that go unrecognized, even though they are somewhat critical to visual or emotional, or you know, just sometimes the logistics of the existence. And I came once I saw the development or spoke to you more about what you were expecting, but it just I think what really hit first was when you really honed on the landscape that started to direct it into a certain place for me. And these things tend to pop up in my mind, that, you know, my romance with the silk cotton tree has been one since I was a child. And when...
Darwin, do you know what a silk cotton tree is?
I do not.
I thought, since you're sharing this evening, I mean, many yes. of the listeners will, but again, we do have listeners overseas, believe it or not. So the silk cotton tree is a very sort of iconic tree in the Bahamas, which grows with these massive roots. Mm-hmm. When we drove through Fox Hill roundabout, we drove through that really lovely area with the yep. big trees with the giant roots. There's a couple there. There was an amazing one actually in Parliament Square right behind, you know, and that's in all the postcards
that's
from the
right.
1800s, which mm-hmm. they cut down.
That's right.
Now they're nationally protected. But yes. So just a little backstory. So you continue.
That particular tree is... It's relevant to the region as well as, and I took the, from there I springboarded on the idea just in my head how, you know, the silk cotton tree can be found regionally, the Caribbean, even in South Florida, and Western Africa. Okay. Those are the noted areas where they're recognized, they're embraced, they're a part of the culture, they're a part of the conversation.
Here they're very often where you find the gathering of people sitting and having, you know, under the shade, because yes. it's a very big shade tree. So that is the classic sort of gathering spot for a community.
And it's the site of revolution.
Site of revolution. And it's a meeting place. And going back to my portfolio, a presentation of etchings, there I had done a very lovely, very quiet looking etching called Meeting Place. And from there, it just culminated from there. And then I started going deeper with the research of it, and this really finding the dark history of this particular tree. And it's called Silent Sentinels because it protects, and what it also protects physically, it protects culturally because of its history with ghosts and colonialism, that dirty word. And from there it just really developed. And again, like Passing Ports and Other, the layers and dimensions, when you start peeling them away, you know, it's a learning experience for me, because it then tends to tell me how I think about things, how I feel about things. And you know, this particular tree I've engaged to a certain degree with since I was a child, because I used to climb trees, despite everyone's, you know,
I
protest.
Know, right? Exactly. Get down from the tree, you're going to get dirty.
Right.
So we're going to have to just quickly go to a short break and we can pick that up. And I thought that was very interesting, the idea of isolation is something I'd like to talk about, because, of course, island communities, that's a big issue. So we just, that was Holly Perotti, who was just speaking about her work, Silent Sentinels, in the show Field Notes, which is currently on show at the Mercado in New York and was curated by Holly Bino, who's also sitting with us in the studio tonight and is the current chief curator at the NAGB, and also Mr. Darren Brown, who's a New York-based collector who was recently in that show, and we're speaking about Caribbean art, African-American art, how they intersect, and you know, where we're going with those practices. And we'll continue that conversation right after the break. You're listening to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, I'm the director of the NAGB, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio, and we'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, I'm the director of the National Art Gallery, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. You can also live stream us at www.guardiantalkradio.com. So, Darwin, you can tell all your friends in New York that Wednesday night at 6:30, they can listen to you on the radio, on The Blank Canvas. So it does live stream. You're on the same time zone as us. So we expect you to be listening.
Very nice.
So www.guardiantalkradio.com. Listen. So I know Holly has a question for Holly. I have a question for you, Darwin, which is you spoke a little bit to it, but you know what both Hollies are speaking about is a very conceptual approach to working, and they're speaking about, you know, a lot of ideas, and generally. Outside of the Caribbean, anyhow, I have found in my travels that this always surprises people. Mm-hmm. So the number one comment I got when Tavara Strawn had the Venice Biennale Pavilion 2 years ago was, well, that was amazing, but wow, it was so conceptual. And I would always say, well, yeah, actually, you know, we have concepts too. What was your impression? I mean, if someone had said to you, as someone who's been sort of deeply involved in the art world since 2002, as you said, and mostly, you know, in American production, if someone had said Caribbean art to you, Bahamian art to you, what would have been your first thought? And what has it? How has that been for you discovering now so much more and what it really is?
That's a perfect question, because it exactly explains why I have to go back to see the show. It explains why I made the comment that I didn't really get it. I didn't have time to really take it in while I was there this past Friday, because at first glance of Holly's show, I knew that there was a lot there that I didn't grasp. Mm-hmm. Partly, and I knew that I needed to dig deeper because I knew a little bit about your professional background. I'm somewhat familiar with ARC magazine, a wonderful publication. And so from my familiarity with the magazine, I have come to find that there's a wide array of artists working in the Caribbean who are thinking very deeply about ideas and expressing them very beautifully. When I look at the way that you have curated that magazine from issue to issue, and within each issue, it let me know that this is a person who really understands that space of creative production, that is Caribbean creative production. So to simply know that this show was put together by Holly let me know that there's something very important being said here. And then for me to not really grasp it on first look let me know that, wow, this is why I do the art thing, because it's an opportunity for me to grow. And I trust her curatorial vision enough to know that me not getting it on first glance means that I don't want to use the word ignorant in a pejorative way, in a negative way, but it means that this is a teaching moment for me. So I have to come back, slow down, and take it in. But I think to your question, what would be my original kind of description of Caribbean art? It's much like you described at the beginning of the segment. you know, conch shells, beaches, you know, bright colors, and so forth. Happy beach scenes, you know, mm-hmm. things that tourists are most often bombarded with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I expect it's been a happy discovery that there's more.
It's a very happy discovery.
Yeah, I think that was something that I was thinking about as I was putting together the show, a way in which all of my information and the research that I've been doing over the last, you know, few years, how it would manifest in a space. So we're looking at, you know, deep ideas. We're thinking about conceptual practices. And we're also thinking about the stereotypes that have been, you know, propagated into the world outside of our space. And how do we debunk the ways in which people have considered our space? So for me, it's really, really important to, number one, to fill space with important ideas that you have to read through slowly. And number two, trust in your viewer. For me, it's really, really supremely important to know that if I give somebody X amount of information, whether it be on colonization or the female body in the Caribbean, or how conceptual practices now being influenced by the work of Robert Smithson, or how MSS's literary work factors into the reading of somebody like Gilles-Élie de Cossac's Lambeau pieces, the collage pieces that are in the show. It takes time to get into these ideas. But once you're able to find that like thread, then it's really, really easy and it's really, really poetic. And you don't really engage with the trauma too much because of all of the dynamic information that is presented. So with HP's work, Silent Sentinels, I thought it was really amazing how you dealt with issues of, as Amanda was saying, isolation, issues of like violence and trauma and secrets.
And also because I think it's important, very so interesting that you picked the landscape, because that seems to have been the barrier to why we are considered sort of a non-thinking people. Right. It's because it's always about, isn't it pretty down there?
Right.
Let's all go hang it.
Yep.
And to take that thing and actually say, well, what else does the landscape say? I think it was a really important step.
Yeah, that was a way to actually get into the presentation, was to take two beautiful compositions and install them in a very non-conventional way. But how it draws you into the actual, the piece itself, is that they're beautiful photographs of a very serene, quiet place. And that's the foot in the door, if any.
Yeah, the foot in the door is the beautiful prints, but the resin pieces with the nails like sent through them.
The implied violence there
is really
absolutely
powerful.
It seems that the nail is there for practical purposes, to affix the fiberglass resin pieces, to speak more of those. They're a direct cast of a limb that I found in the graveyard of the tree that I photographed. And
A tree limb. Yeah, just to clarify.
A tree limb, yes. And they...
you never know, right?
Yes, that's true. Yes, a tree limb. I wanted to include the violence of the tree itself as well. You know, in my opinion, in my romantic idea, these trees are covered with these thorns as a means of armor to protect themselves from us, our expectation of their service to us. The reasons why the other part of the title is "We Will Not Talk About It," that it was a must, and because of the history of this tree. In that one of the, very quickly I'll talk about one of the mythologies of it, is that in the Caribbean, you can trap someone's soul in the trunk of this tree by consulting an Obe man, or voodoo man, to conjure up the spirits to take someone's soul and place it in this tree. And how you trap that person's soul in this tree is by driving a nail in the trunk of this tree. I would actually like to go around the region to find these trees that have these nails driven in them, beyond the poster boards or the, you know, the informational, the reason, you know, people now use them probably in a practical way, just to see that experience, to really embrace that as well. And it was important to take the beautiful composition and then add that. Somewhat not a subversive way, but just in a suggestive way, of the violence of the history of this tree in this region, and it goes unnoticed.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, it even affected how we both considered trade and getting things to and from certain spaces. So
yes.
Ideally, I think back in the 14th, 15th century, the seeds were trapped in here because that's how they crossed the Atlantic to come to, you know, the West.
Mm-hmm. So does the silk cotton tree come from West Africa?
That's right.
That's its native, and it was transplanted here.
That's right.
And now, you know, HP is trying to get this material from the Bahamas to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, legally we can't transport saplings or soil.
No.
So you had to figure out a way to, you know, work around that.
To return it, yes.
Yeah, to have that thing be present because it's a really, really powerful object to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the cast, the resin cast had a certain appeal, you know, that box, that final box in its resting place, it's almost a monumentalization of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's diminutive because it's a small piece, but in my mind, it had a very, very large presence.
Yes, that,
and so
that
I
was
thought
the
that
last.
That was really a beautiful way to think about finishing the scene, as you will.
Yes, well, I didn't really get too much into the whole transportation or returning an object back to New York, because again, that was another layer that had to, was developing as I spoke about it, as I presented the piece. But my father's family actually came through Ellis Island. So to take a piece of something that I held dear, I still hold dear, and return it to New York to see how it would function, how it would thrive, would it even survive that trip? By survive, could I get it through U.S. Customs?
Which then also speaks to, you know, the immigration that from the past, forced
Absolutely.
Immigration, and the current immigration. Because, again, so many people of the Caribbean must go, in a way, or feel they must, to actually continue their education, their career, and, you know, all the difficulties of that, of being from here and the visa and this and whatever. And so many Bahamians living all over the world.
Yeah.
And feel that they don't have opportunities here, and so they must go and finagle ways to
absolutely
get
learn
where
the
they
want
to be, learn the system. Yep. So that speaks to that as well.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that I really enjoyed about knowing that the show was on view at Mocada was the fact that it gives Mocada an opportunity to expand its vision, and it gives that community an opportunity to better understand their own history by having a lens into the creative practice of Caribbean artists and now taking in the depth of story that's being told by the individual artists and captured, you know, by the curator. It helps, let's say, an African-American viewer see the similarity between the Caribbean and Africa connection and their own, let's say, African-American and Africa connection. And in parallel, they now see, wait a minute, these people in the Caribbean are much more than I'm getting from my tourist presentations, if you will. We have a lot more, you know, in Kismet. Maybe I should spend a little more time understanding their story, their struggle, and so forth. And as a result, maybe enrich in my own life.
And also something that you and I have discussed over the last 2 days is, you know, this idea that we have separate histories what that does to us. So, you know, you and I discussed this idea of like Black history in America, right? It's Black History Month, and you can go to school and you can study Black history, you know, outside of studying quote unquote regular history, American history. And, you know, I spoke to the fact that, you know, you see how certain things in certain periods of time are necessary, but maybe now there's the time to think about actually how our histories are intertwined and making one history. And that speaks also to our experience here. Because again, you know, most people outside of the Caribbean think the Caribbean is a space of people of African descent.
Right.
Whereas it's much more complicated than that. And our, as Holly can speak to, and Holly can, I mean, you know, we all have a lot of mixed stuff going on. And how do we, to move forward, and this is a particular interest in the United States right now with everything that's going on, but also here, how do we move forward not being separate anymore?
Right.
But being one, you know? And I think the Caribbean story can actually help the United States a little bit, because we've had a very different, also very difficult, but a very different narrative in terms of that. So, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I feel as though Haiti piloted independence and sovereignty in the West.
Agreed.
That the influence that has had in the Caribbean and in the U.S. is, you know, tantamount to all sorts of changes regarding how we think about Black experiences, how we think about Black empowerment, how we think about the contents of our spaces, how I understand my Creolote to be something very, very specific, even though you can't see it.
Mm.
Or even though maybe you'll be able to see it, but you denounce it, because somebody like me cannot have that experience. No, but I own that experience and you can't discredit it, right? So.
Right.
That's the standpoint in which I'm coming from. I think one of the most conflicting things about trying to narrow the gap between the African American experience and the Caribbean diaspora Black experience in America is the fact that perhaps during the civil rights movement and when we were also becoming post-independent countries, a lot of Caribbean people traveled to America. And mm-hmm. there was this like conflict because, you know, we're ambitious people. The people who make it from the Caribbean are supremely ambitious. I mean, mm-hmm. we have like a backing behind us that, you know, we're driven, articulate, we have everything together.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of integration in America was really very hard for us. And I think now it's become, now I think we have that open space where we can begin to speak about our differences, but also honor the similarities that we share within our histories, because mm-hmm. it is not only close, it is intertwined. You cannot
actually. That's what I mean, it's intertwined. You can't share, but intertwined. Exactly.
One from the other.
No. Yeah.
Yes, we may have ended up in many different spaces, you know, smaller countries, etc., but we share a kind of understanding of each other.
Mm-hmm.
I share an understanding of African Americans, without a doubt. I lived in Brooklyn for 7 years, I lived in New York for 10 years. It was stomping ground because my Caribbean people were there. And I also identified with Black Americans because of their history.
Well, I think the Caribbean people, we can assimilate anywhere. We have done. I mean, there are pockets of the world that you don't expect to find Caribbean nationals. And look at Kent in England. In the southeast part of England. I mean, there's a very strong Bahamian group of students there. And I only learned that because I took one, a friend of mine, who moved there to study, and she found 5 Bahamian students within 2 days, one of which was the local DJ.
Yeah.
as far as, you know, New Zealand, there's a pocket of people from St. Vincent. I mean, you know, like we're a country of 104,000 people. But, you know, you go anywhere and we've, like, inhabited and we've mm-hmm. become, you know, many different types in order to, like, fit in. But we have that retention. We understand where we come from.
Yes.
So I think it's really culturally important to understand that the Caribbean is everything, because it was
mm-hmm.
the first globalized place on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what Caribbean no. Crossroads was trying to do. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they managed, but I think that was part of the... did you see that show, Darwin? We only got 3 minutes.
So the catalogue.
Yeah. Because it was a very like rambling show. I mean, it was interesting, definitely. It was a huge topic to take on, but I think that was a lot of the
like in 4 parts.
In 4 parts, exactly. That was part of the premise, was that the Caribbean was the first melting pot. It was the trading, you know, was actually long before it was the center. And hopefully we'll be the center again, right? With all of us.
This is why we're working so hard.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. So what are your next plans, HP?
My next plans? It's really looking at my portfolio, seeing the direction it's going, you know, capitalizing on these last three projects.
Yeah, we actually didn't even talk about Vienna.
No.
I completely spaced out about that. But now we've only got 2 minutes left because you actually have a show coming up. So you're really sort of moving, broadening the circle. So. Mm-hmm. I was invited with my husband to curate a show in Vienna at an art gallery there, which is sort of almost 10 years on from the Funky Nassau show that I did in Germany mm-hmm. in the Nassauische Kunstverein. And a lot of the works are drawn from the NE7 that Holly and Michael curated, but then we've actually added some other ones. So mm-hmm. you're going to be also in showing work. So you're showing work in New York now, in Vienna, and we're hoping that's going to also, I mean, that's a group show of Bahamian mm-hmm. art that we're mm-hmm. hoping is going to change as Darwin has discovered that we got more going on down here. Right? That's what people always say to me. They can, of course, now name Tavara Strawn. They can name Laura Monroe. And I always, my mantra is, there's more where that came from.
That's right. That's right.
Right?
For sure.
So, and that show is going to be September 22nd in Vienna, Austria, with, I think, how many artists are we taking, Holly?
30.
30 Bahamian yeah. artists. So wow. We're pretty excited about that. I have to do a tiny little bit of housekeeping. I just want to say that we have some artists back home for the summer. One is Alistair Stevenson, a ceramicist who's studying in Beijing, China. He's been there, I think, for 2 years. He has another 3 years to go. He's going to be giving a talk at the NAGB on Thursday the 20th about his experiences and what he's learning in the ceramic arts out there. So I'd like people to come out and support Ali Stevenson, who's a good Bahamian boy, but he's in living in China for 5 years. And that's about it upcoming. I'd like to thank everyone for being in the studio with me tonight. So Holly Bino.
Thank you, Amanda.
So great that you're finally official at the NAGB. We're so happy to have you be part of the team. Darwin Brown, thank you for joining us. I know it was impromptu, but it was great to have you in the studio. And Holly Parodi.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for being here, and all the best for all these projects you have ongoing. So let's take Bahamian art to the world, man. You have been listening to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, the director of the National Art Gallery, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening this evening, and good night.